if you just break under control, you know, you see that ball hit the dirt, that second hop is going to bounce up. And if you break right away, you pay attention to break right away. It's mid-thigh or above, knee-high or above every time. You don't have to worry about a short hop. And I got so tired of watching infielders hesitate, then back up, then they can't throw the guy out. Or they hesitate, then they go, and then they got to pick a short hop. They got to slap at the ball. There just has to be an easier way. So if you keep the other team from scoring, the worst you're going to come up with is tie, and you're going to keep playing and playing and playing.
Right.
So I thought, you're not always going to hit. You're not always going to score runs. But maybe if you can catch and throw the ball correctly, maybe you can keep the other team from doing the same thing.
That's right.
And so that just kind of evolved that way.
You're dialed in to the ABCA's Calls from the Clubhouse podcast, connecting our coaches with some of the best baseball minds in our game. Now here's your host, Jeremy Schiedinger.
Broadcasting from the ABCA National Office here in Greensboro, North Carolina, and welcome back to the show. Another week brings us all another tremendous conversation with the very best teachers in our game. And these guys love to share, they love to learn, and that is simply the ABCA defined. These are coaches who check their ego at the door, they're on a constant search for knowledge. They embrace engaging with others. They take in as much insight and info as they can because they know that's the approach that helps us grow. That's the approach that helps us develop, helps us stay current, always challenging ourselves. So if that feels good to you, perfect, wear that. Join the tens of thousands of coaches worldwide who dial into this show each and every week, and let's get to work. First and foremost, we want to thank our proud sponsor of this podcast, our great friends over at AstroTurf. They are the leaders in the clubhouse for the turf industry, and if you've ever seen images from facilities like Vanderbilt or Tulane, Wichita State, Oklahoma, just to name a few, and you're in the market for a field upgrade, you make sure you reach out to the great folks at AstroTurf. See for yourself what they've done for ballparks around the country. And when you do, it's easy to see why AstroTurf has been ahead of the curve for almost 50 years. And for every coach out there looking to improve themselves and their infielders, there are a number of resources and terrific coaches out there you can connect with, but there is power in getting back to the basics and pulling back the curtain on what some of the very best are teaching and how they go about their business each and every day. So we welcome in Miami Marlins infield coach Perry Bone Hill to the podcast, and talk about a guy who is keeping it simple on the infield, and the Marlins infielders are flourishing under his leadership. He was named MLB's Infield Coach of the Year for 2017, a year that saw the Marlins lead all of Major League Baseball with the fewest team errors at 73. 73, guys, that's unreal, and less than 50 of those occurred on the infield over the course of 162 games. It's just awesome. And we'll learn from Coach Hill his patented six F's to fielding as he breaks down each individual element and the details inside his plan to teaching infield play. Plus, we're going to open up his daily routine. Again, very simple, very calculated, that his Marlin infielders attack each day and gets them warmed up and paying attention to the fundamentals on the infield. We also get Bone rolling on first base play. This is an overlooked area for most infield coaches, and Perry offers us some ideas for footwork around the bag. This is an awesome episode. What a great person. It's obvious to see why his players absolutely adore Coach Hill. So grab your leather. Let's pick up the fungo. Let's go to work on the infield with Perry Hill from the Miami Marlins as Bone joins our Calls from the Clubhouse podcast. So get ready, coaches. This great interview is coming at you right now. You clicked into this show looking to get better as an infield coach? Welcome. You're in exactly the right spot. And just like in any walk of life, you want to get better, you connect with the best. Well, we're going to talk to the guy who just got recognized as MLB's Infield Coach of the Year, the infield coach that led the Miami Marlins to making the fewest errors in all of Major League Baseball, a guy with multiple gold gloves inside his infield core, a guy with the ring from the 2003 World Series. We're talking with one of the very best teaching professionals when it comes to infield play. We're connecting today with Miami Marlins infield coach Perry Hill. Bone, thanks for being on the call with us today.
Thanks, Sheets. It's my pleasure.
Well, thanks for jumping on the podcast with us today. And it's really interesting how we arrived at this show. I ran across one of your videos on social media, started looking into you a little bit more, and then connected with my great friend Larry Owens, head coach at Bellarmine University in Louisville, Kentucky, a guy that had spent a lot of his career inside professional baseball. Your name came up talking infield play, and I went, man, I just watched this video. You ought to get him on the podcast sheets. Man, that would be a great guest to talk through infield play, how he keeps it so simple but so detailed. His guys love him. And I think that speaks volumes when guys on inner circles speak that way about someone. So I think that's where we'll start this interview. Let's go back to spending 40 years inside of coaching, man, 25 up on the major league level. And we want to make sure we know your backstory that got you to a place where now you serve as the Miami Marlins infield coach.
That goes back a long way. Probably some of the coaches that are listening, this weren't even born at sure. that particular time. Mm-hmm. But I had some bad luck early. I've had some knee issues. I've had six knee surgeries, and wow. 5 years ago, I finally had it replaced, and that kind of derailed my plans as my college and pro career started to form its beginnings. So I was, I was just part of the game. I was kind of, I dealt with it the best I could. I was been released. I ended up going to Mexico just because I wanted to play at that point in my life. I knew I was never going to get to the big leagues. I just wanted to play, gain some experience. I thought that someday I might want to coach. I didn't know. So I wanted to play all I could, tinker with things all I could, come up with theories all I could, and then, see what would happen. And sure enough, after a few years down there, I had bumped into Tom Grieve and Marty Scott, who were the farm director and assistant farm director with the Texas Rangers. And I kind of tricked both of those guys. And before you know it, I'm a rookie ball coach of the Rangers way back in 1984. And just kind of progressed to where I am today.
How about that? Yeah, I want you to know, and I'm going to keep this in perspective for you, Bone. In 1984, I was 3 years old.
In 1984, I was a rookie ball coach in Tri-Cities, Washington.
Oh,
we won the Northwest League Championship that year.
Oh.
So, yeah, when you were 3 years old, I got my first ring.
That's so awesome. Well, we've talked and we connected, obviously, before today, and I told Perry, man, as an infield guy, grew up all my life, I thought I knew some stuff until you really start talking to guys that are just out there doing it on an extremely successful level. And so I've always, I'm bowing down to you on this show as we really want to open up some unique things inside infield play. But I think one question we talked about that we really want to get into, and we were just talking before we hit the record button, is one of discussing your growth as a coach. So go back to that first position in professional baseball. Who were you then as a younger coach, and how have you progressed over your career?
Oh, geez. leaps and bounds.
Sure.
It's like you said, you think you know something, and then you get around and you watch the game and you say, well, why did that happen? Or why couldn't I have done that to make that easier?
Mm-hmm.
Or let's give this a try. It's at the rookie ball level. If it doesn't work, we can try something else. And
mm-hmm.
and there's just the great thing about coaches in high school, college, the minor leagues is you have the ability to tinker with things and try to figure out a program that works.
Mm.
So if your desire is to be the Division I coach or a major league coach, the training ground that you receive in high school or the minor leagues is invaluable. I've tweaked so many things over the years. I've come now where most of my program is pretty well set in stone.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still open to new stuff, and I would never turn down somebody else's opinion. But the minor leagues, I spent a lot of time in the minor leagues, and to me, it was the most valuable lessons that I've ever learned.
Well, that's an interesting point. I'm really glad you walked into that. We talk a lot on this podcast about making sure we're challenging what we're doing inside this game, never settling for where we're at in our knowledge base, but always seeking out new information, connecting with more coaches, taking in their information, certainly not having to use all of it, but digesting it and taking out of it what we like and bringing it into our programs, a game where you'll never have it figured out. And I think that walks right into this question, Bone. When you're looking at your last few years in coaching, can you point to a moment where you recently learned something that has stayed with you, maybe changed your approach to coaching?
Well, there is, as a matter of fact.
Sure.
There was an instance about, I don't know, maybe 7 years ago, 5-7 years ago, that I came up with this thing. I don't know if anybody listening follows me on Instagram or Twitter, but I don't do a lot of stuff on there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I take a lot of pictures of ballparks, and I talk about a lot of things that we work on, and a lot of my sayings I put on there, like 27 outs, no more.
Mm-hmm.
Play the marks, you know, which is a whole different story. Another one is ball hits dirt. I came up with ball hits dirt a little while ago, and I just kept watching and watching the balls that were hit that infielders would back up on,
mm-hmm.
or they would hesitate before they broke.
Mm-hmm.
And they were always catching these balls on the run, short hops, catching the ball, having to throw the ball off balance on the run. This goes way, way back too. When I talk about off balance throws, I grew up in Texas and I used to watch Daryl Royal and the University of Texas.
Yeah,
I wasn't a big wishbone fan because I like the pass. I like the open up game in football. But I remember Daryl Royal said one time, he said, if you throw the football off balance, think about how you're throwing it and what the word says. It says off balance.
Mm-hmm.
So why would you throw a ball on the run if you don't have to? Why be off balance? Of course, that thinking has changed now. There's a lot of quarterbacks that roll out and throw the ball just well. But I remember that point sticking in my head. So one day I was sitting around the batting cage. My work was done. I was watching the hitters. And I noticed these balls that were the first time the ball made contact with the bat, that the ball would hit the dirt. If you can envision the circle around home plate,
sure.
The dirt circle, that ball would, that's the first place the ball would hit. It would hit that dirt. And then I started watching where it bounced and where the second hop was.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, hold on here. I think I got this figured out.
Okay.
So that's when I came up with ball hit dirt. So if anybody follows me on Twitter this coming year or has in the past, they'll always see every once in a while I'll put a hashtag in there, ball hits dirt. What that means is, if you're an infielder and the hitter takes a swing and the first place the ball hits, if it goes straight down and hits that dirt, you should break to the ball as fast as you can. Go hard.
Mm.
It's going to bounce one time right there in the dirt.
Yep.
It's going to usually go over the mound and bounce again. But if you break at the same time that ball hits the dirt, that second hop is about double play depth or a step or two in front of double play depth,
mm-hmm.
about mid-thigh or above. You don't have to worry about a short hop. You don't have to worry about breaking down. You just go catch that ball, mid-thigh, set your feet. Don't throw off balance. Set your feet, replace your feet, and get your out.
Love
so that's
it.
Something I learned just recently, just by watching the game.
Love that. It took less than 10 minutes for you to deliver some certified audio gold for our guys. And if you're wondering, go over to Twitter, guys. You can find Perry Hill on there, @phill_bone, @phill_bone, if you want to check out what he's doing there on Twitter. But that's a great point. And I love the fact, again, a guy that's seen so many games across so many different seasons and levels, and you can obviously come back to that great point.
You know, sometimes you'll have the first or third baseman playing in, you know, even with the bag or maybe a step or two behind the bag.
Mm-hmm.
You know, usually if you break right away, you get that first hop for you. But if you're playing back normal depth on all the positions, if you just break under control, you see that ball hit the dirt, if you just break under control, that second hop is going to bounce up. And if you break right away, if you pay attention and break right away, it's mid-thigh or above, knee-high or above every time.
Ooh,
you don't have to worry about a short hop. And I got so tired of watching infielders hesitate, then back up,
mm-hmm.
then they can't throw the guy out.
Mm-hmm.
Or they hesitate, then they go, and then they got to pick a short hop. They got to slap at the ball.
Right.
And try to ask, there's just has to be an easier way. And the way the way you practice this, in my opinion, that's a hard play to practice.
Yeah, yeah,
it's a very hard because you have to have bat speed. You can't. This is really hard to do with a fungo.
That's right. That's
so,
right.
The way I have my guys practice this is in their turn around the batting cage,
mm-hmm.
as they're waiting for their turn to jump in the cage while they're watching their buddies hit. Just watch. If they swing that first ball hits the dirt, in their mind they should say go. Then watch where the second hop ends up. That's how we practice that play.
I love that. I think you've got a bunch of coaches listening to the show, Perry, that are taking mental ground balls right now. And that's such a great teaching. But really, that's a great teaching point. It makes total sense. So now that we know what, you know, ball hits dirt now, and we know exactly where you're going with that idea. You know, I think the beauty of the way you teach infield play, and we're going to open this up, is you keep things very simple and there's not a lot of eye wash. Actually, there's zero eye wash. And it's really to the point. It's the basics and the fundamentals. And I think you've carved that out over time. If you could, for our guys, before we really open up the true, you know, devil in the details inside your infield approach, can you open up where you used to be? How did you first get into infield play? Where were you then, especially compared to where you've landed now and what you teach?
I grew up in the Dallas-Fort Worth area of Texas, and they had the double-A minor league team of the Baltimore Orioles was there.
Okay.
At the old stadium where the Rangers play.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't very far from there. I was always interested in infield play, but the more I watched guys that came up through the system, like Doug the Sensei, Bobby Gritch, Junior Kennedy, you know, I could go on and on and on. Some of these names that your listening audience now have no idea maybe who these guys are.
We'll look them up.
Because I'm a little bit older.
Sure.
But that's when I really became enthralled with that.
Mm-hmm.
I just started to watch and notice and saying, you know, this is pretty cool. And mm-hmm. and I remember that the Baltimore Orioles were the first team that really stressed pitching and defense. And they evolved as time went on to Earl Weaver's philosophy of the three-run homer.
That's right.
I get that.
Yeah.
But way back when they had Palmer and Cuellar and Dobson, McNally, I mean, they pitched and they caught the ball. I remember Doug the Sensei making a quote one day. I read it and it stuck in my mind. He said, if you keep the other team from scoring, the worst you're going to come up with is tie, and you're going to keep playing and playing and playing.
Right.
So I thought, you're not always going to hit. You're not always going to score runs.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe if you can catch and throw the ball correctly, maybe you can keep the other team from doing the same thing.
That's right.
And so that just kind of evolved that way.
That's awesome. And again, it's involved into having tremendous success. You talk about being the infield coach of the year this year. You guys made the fewest errors in Major League Baseball. And I think over the course of that season, when you really look at making that few of errors, man, you're doing something right. And that's what we want to really open up and get you and your content out for our coaches. And let's go into the six F's. That's where your concrete foundation is of your infield play comes back to the six F's of fielding. And we're going to walk through these one by one. And if you're paying attention, guys, to our show, we're talking about feet, field, funnel, footwork, fire, and follow, but we're going to start with feet. Can you open up feet for us in terms of how you lay that out for your players and how you walk into teaching infield play?
Okay. First of all, Sheets, let me start off by saying that this is basically designed to make, I don't really like to call it a routine play, because a routine play, you still got to make every play, mm-hmm. try to make every play. But I'm talking about three or four steps left, three or four steps right at me. To me, especially at the level that I'm at, those have to be out.
That's right.
They have to be out.
Yeah.
You can't extend innings. You can't get your starter's pitch count up, especially the colleges. You play 3-game series. Sometimes mm-hmm. we play 3-4-game series. You have to make those plays all the time.
That's it.
Otherwise, in a 3 or 4-game series, you know, you get your pitch count up, your starter's out in the fourth, and you blow up your bullpen in the first game of a 4-game series. And then it can get real ugly. So I'm talking about, when I talk about the six F's, I'm talking about making routine plays that should be made mm-hmm. every single time. I use the hashtag on my Twitter account all the time. It's 27 outs, no more.
That's right.
I mean, I'm not giving you an extra out. If I give you an extra out, I'm in trouble.
Don't you think, Perry, the difference between good and great fielders are the ones that can consistently make the plays 3 feet to the left and the right and right at them?
That's it.
Yeah.
I want that guy, you know, and I know that we have, I know my guys are tremendous athletes like D. Gordon and
mm-hmm.
People like that I've had in the past that can go make the outstanding play. And that's just icing on the cake.
That's it.
What D. Gordon will tell you if he was with us right now, is what he's learned since he came over from L.A. is that he's responsible for catching that ball that he can get in front of every time and making sure that ball's an out.
That's right.
Period.
That's right. All right, open up feet for us, man. Dive into this head first.
Okay, well, the six Fs, I just remember as a young player that sometimes I got bombarded with information. Your arm's too long. Mm-hmm. Get your elbow up. Get your arm up. Hand on top of the ball. And I went, whoa. I mean, that's a lot of stuff to process
mm-hmm.
while some ball's coming at you at some point in time, 80 to 90 miles an hour. So I got to figure this out, make this a little simpler, and make it for dummies like me that can't process a lot of stuff. So I came up with the six F's. The first F is feet. And that's just to put it in layman's terms that everybody uses. That's the ready position.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I explain it to my players that just like a relay race, 4x100, whatever they call that relay race. You don't hand the baton to the guy as he's standing still.
Sure.
He takes a head start, so when he gets the baton, he's already moving.
Mm-hmm.
Well, think about this in baseball. If you're already moving when the ball's in the hitting zone, when the ball's hit, you're going to be a little bit quicker to that ball.
That's right.
So that's the analogy I use all the time. And, you know, I have a certain way that I teach it. There's a million ways to do it. I'm not saying my way's right. There's, you know, you can skin a cat 9 different ways.
That's it.
But what I teach is I just stay in the relaxed mode. I'm looking at home plate, just like I'm having a conversation on the street. Mm-hmm. But as soon as that pitcher makes his first move, whether it's a windup or the stretch, the first time I see his body twitch, I'm getting my glove off of my body. I'm slightly bending my back. I watch the arm, the pitcher's arm, whatever his style is. Once that arm starts to go forward, and I usually try to time it around the ear. Once I see that his throwing arm close to his ear, I'm going to take a small step. Now, small, my definition is half your shoe size.
Okay.
That way I don't get it where the guy's really taking a big step, because that's going to throw the timing off.
That's right. Yep.
So I say half your shoe size. I'll say take a small step. And soon you take a small step, the pitcher's out of the equation now. You take a small step and then you separate both feet. They both go out. If you can imagine a tennis match, if you've ever watched tennis on TV,
absolutely,
see what the receiver does all the time.
That's it.
Once that opponent's racket starts to make the serve and starts to go forward, you'll see that other player take a small step and separate both feet. They'll come down and they'll hit the ground at the same time. It's not going to be right, left, because now you're going to be stronger to your left than your right, because that's your momentum, if you can picture that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not going to be left, right. Now you're going to be stronger to your right, weaker to your left. Both feet come down at the same time. That's the ready position, in my point. It doesn't matter if you're throwing 45 miles an hour from 40 feet, or if you're throwing 100 miles an hour from 60 feet, 6 inches.
Mm-hmm.
Once that happens, once your both feet hit the ground using that timing method, you'll hear the ball hit the bat. Now, once again, this is an easy play to practice.
Mm-hmm.
When you're waiting for your turn to hit in the batting cage, turn your back to the hitter, look at the BP pitcher, and then do that formula. Mm-hmm. And once both feet hit the ground, you're going to hear at the same time both feet hit the ground, you're going to hear the guy in the cage, the bat's going to hit the ball every time.
Love that. Love
and
that.
That's how you practice that. That's how you get multiple reps in little bitty time.
Coaches, I should have warned you, this is probably going to be a take feverish notes episode, because I know Bone's going to go into some really great details and give you some great tips. That's a great point that gets us going in what most people would call pre-pitch. You know, and we've seen so many different variations of that in terms of Pedroia likes to come up about 6 feet off the ground and land, and there's some guys that take real subtle steps. Obviously,
right.
You're going to stay in that subtle, but you're getting yourself prepared in a good ready position to react quickly when the ball is hit.
Well, let me back up to Pedroia just for a second. That works for him.
Yeah.
Like I said, there's different ways to skin a cat.
That's right.
You know, the reason I like to keep my feet close to the ground is if I did that same footwork, bouncing that high on the secondary lead at first base, I would probably have a coach tell me, you can't run until your feet come back off the ground. So mm-hmm. don't bounce so high.
Mm-hmm.
Keep your feet low to the ground. So I'm thinking, well, it's okay here, but it's not okay there. What's the difference?
Sure.
And that's you have point. To be careful as a coach to send any mixed signals.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I just prefer to keep everything consistent related to everything I do on the field.
I love it.
Anyway, that's my 2 cents on that.
Sure.
Okay, field. Field, my opinion, field is I'll try to speed it up. When I was a young player, I always have coaches say, you got to get your hands out front, get your hands out front. And what I did is I figured out that when I got my hands out front, 2 things happened that I didn't want to happen. I started to lose my balance. And 2, my glove would come off the ground. I said, how am I going to catch ground ball with my glove off the ground? So I got to get my hands out front, but there's got to be a different way to get my hands out front.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you spread your feet. When you break down the field of ground ball, your feet should be 2 to 3 inches past your shoulders. Not shoulder width, they should be much wider. And it's going to be different for everybody. Depends on how tall you are, your body type.
Sure.
Everybody's going to be different. But you're going to have a wide base. If you have a wide base, now all you have to do is just lay your glove down. It's going to be plenty far out in front of you. You don't have to get your hands out front. It's going to happen automatically. And the same token, to be a good hitter, to be a good consistent hitter at any level, there's 2 things you have to see at the same time. You have to see the ball and the bat. If you want to be a consistent infielder, you have to just see 2 things at the same time. You have to see the ball and your glove. In peripheral vision, if you can't see your glove, that means your glove is too close to your body. If that ball takes any kind of hop the last 6 to 8 inches, you're not going to react to it.
Uh-huh.
That's when guys have balls go off the heel of their glove or off their wrist, and they think, oh, shoot, that's a bad hop. I get the next one. That's not a bad hop. You didn't react because you didn't see the ball.
Mm-hmm.
So we stress really a wide base, which enables our hands to get out front, which creates a great balance point, and it enables us to see the ball and the glove at the same time.
That's a great point. You know, Perry, I've been really fortunate to be able to go out on our ABCA Barnstormers Clinics tour and heard some of the very best teaching professionals inside of college or high school baseball talk about infield play. And one of the coaching cues that came out that made a ton of sense to me was we always bark about our guys and they're fielding the ball deep. It's back between their feet and they're certainly not getting on a level with the ball and seeing it out in front, letting their glove work out in front. And the coaching cue is very simple to your point. Hey, just get a wider base, spread your feet out. And when that happens, they just kind of hinge at the hips. They get their glove out in a better position and they're down ready to field. Does that work for you?
This sounds a little bit long and complicated as I talk about it. But once you explain it one time to the players, feet and then field, once you break it down, all you have to do now is say wide base.
That's it.
You get a wide base, got to get wider, got to get wider.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes care of your butt getting lower. That takes care of your glove out in front. It takes care of everything. So obviously the first time through this, you have to be a little bit detailed. So you lay your structure, your foundation down. Mm-hmm. But from then on, it's really one or two word codes.
That's it. Absolutely. Now we got into this yesterday and I'm gonna hopefully scratch this itch for you. You're a huge push through guy. No, I'm just joking. You're a huge funnel guy, but I want to get you going on that because there is, those infield guys out there that really settle on one or the other and everybody tried to dig their heels in, but you've got some really great points for that. Talk through the funnel.
Feet, field, now the ball is actually in your glove, mm-hmm. starting to roll in your glove. I teach the funnel, the shape of a funnel. We've all used one before.
Mm-hmm.
It's got that big area and it narrows itself down to a small area. Let whatever you're using through. I'm a big funnel guy for these reasons. If I'm in the backyard playing catch with you or my buddy, mm-hmm. and he throws the ball wide left or wide right, the first thing I'm going to do with that ball before I throw it back to him is I'm going to bring it to the middle of my body, exchange it with my throwing hand, and then throw it back.
Mm-hmm.
Nowhere in that sequence am I going to catch the ball and take it toward that player. Then reach out with my hand and throw it back. And we've all been playing catch since we were 3, 4, 5 years old.
That's right.
And I don't think anybody's done it any differently. That's number one.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, mm-hmm. any sport that you throw something, it happens in the middle of your body.
Love
period.
It.
For instance, if you and I are going to fight, the coaches that are listening will have to kind of play along with me now. If we're going
right.
to fight, where are you holding your fist?
Right in the
are you holding
them
out in front of you? Are you holding them off to the side? Are you holding them down by your belt? Is it behind your right shoulder? Where are your fists? They're right in your chest, right in the middle of your body.
That's
because
right.
that's where your power is. That's where your center is. That's where you throw a punch from.
Mm-hmm.
You watch all these boxers, all these MAs, that's where they're holding their fist, and that's where they throw their punch from. Let's take a quarterback. Tom Brady takes a snap. He goes back to pass. Where is he holding that football? Is he holding it at his belt? Is he holding it above his head? Is he holding it out in front of him? Is he holding it behind his right shoulder? He's holding it as he goes back to pass right in the middle of his body.
Mm-hmm.
How about a basketball player making a pass? Well, I'll call it the chest pass.
Mm-hmm.
You have different passes, but the basic pass in basketball is right there from the middle of your body. That's how we all learn to do it. As we play Pee Wee basketball or junior high, middle school basketball, that's the first pass we learned. That's where we throw the ball. How about a pitcher? Where is the pitcher? Where is his hands? I don't care if he's straight over the top, three-quarters, sidearm, submarine. Where are the last place a pitcher's hands are before they separate? Are they at his belt? Are they at his back of his shoulder? Are they over his head? Are they behind him? It's right in the middle of his body.
That's it.
You're an outfielder and there's a fly ball and you catch that ball. Now you're going to throw this guy off the plate. You get behind it. Where are you going to take that ball? Are you going to take it to your belt? You're going to take it to your shoulder? You're going to take it behind your body? So my point being is everybody else takes it to the middle of their body.
Mm-hmm.
Why shouldn't we as infielders take it to the middle of our body?
Terrific.
To me, it
point.
Doesn't make any sense.
That's right.
So that's why I teach the funnel. Here's the key about the funnel. Now, there's four key points about the funnel that you never have to worry about again if you teach the funnel. I teach funnel, thumbs down. Once I get the ball to the middle of my body, somewhere, in the sternum area or below, right in that area, breastbone. As soon as the ball or my glove gets to that point, I separate both hands, both thumbs go down. The thumb on my glove, the thumb on my throwing hand. Mm-hmm. Now, if you'll act this out with me, Sheet,
I'm doing it.
You'll funnel to the middle of your body like that, and now you'll funnel. Here's four things you never have to worry about ever again.
Okay.
Ever again. Your shoulder, your left arm will create a front side to throw against. It's out there for you. Mm-hmm. It's not what down at your body. And I see a lot of high school, college players throw with no front side. Tell a pitcher or somebody else to throw with no front side and they're going to get hurt real quick. Now you've created your front side automatically. Here's the second thing. Act that out for me. Now take your arm back. Doesn't it stop short automatically? Doesn't it break and stop short? It never goes down. It never gets long. It's never loopy.
That's right.
The other thing is look at your elbow. It's the same height as your shoulder.
That's
get
it.
Your elbow up. It does it for you automatically. And the fourth thing it does, your hand's automatically on top of the ball. Now, I have big leaguers that still ask me to this day, why does my hand have to be on top of the ball? If your hand's on top of the ball, when you take it back, if you go ahead and start to throw and you look at the release point, automatically, your hand will be behind the ball mm-hmm. every single time. Mm-hmm. When you're behind something, that's where you get your power.
That's it.
If you take the ball back with your thumb on the side or thumb up in the air, you're going to get on the side or under it, and you're going to end up pushing the ball. Pie throwers, as we call them.
Mm-hmm.
No power. If you funnel thumbs down, you create a front side, you create a short arm, elbows the same height as your shoulder, and your hand's automatically on top of the ball. Funnel takes care of all that.
Let's walk into this real quick, Bone. If we're talking about the funnel and bringing it out and thumbs down, if there's a high school or youth coach or high school coach or college coach listening to this, and they've got let's call it a middle infielder, shortstop, that his throws always have tail on them. Now, it could be a timing issue, but it could come back to this funnel technique in terms of them not bringing the ball out thumbs down. Like you mentioned, elbow up on top of the baseball. Couldn't that come back to a little bit of that where that ball has that tail on it instead of creating a true carry across the diamond?
Well, I call them slingers. A lot of time, if you catch that ball out front, instead of funneling, if you take the ball away from your body, like if you're a right-handed thrower, you take it to the away from the right side of your body.
Mm-hmm.
Look at all the things that have happened now. Now look, my left shoulder's moving. I'm losing my front side.
Right.
Now I'm making my arm is starting to get long. My throwing arm is starting to get long. Now look naturally where your hand ends up. You're going to end up on the side of the ball single time.
That's right.
Now, if you're a great athlete, you can speed up everything and you can get back on top. More power to you.
Sure.
But when D. Gordon hits that ground ball to you, you got to go three steps to your left or right, you don't have a whole lot of time to think about that stuff.
That's right. Not with him running. That's for sure. That is good. Okay. And I think a lot of coaches might be thinking the same thing. Does it come back to when you field and you're in that funnel position? Do you want your guys to be square to the ground ball or square to home plate? Or is there a slight openness that maybe might guide them toward first base? Where are you at on that in terms of the footwork at the funnel?
You can get square. I prefer square. But I mean, if you're a toe to ball a foot guy,
mm-hmm.
That's okay too.
Okay.
I get really cautious with guys that are really staggered because if you get more staggered, a lot of guys say, well, if I'm staggered, it's easier to move my feet. I can get to my target. But the more your right foot drops, if you're a right-handed thrower, or the more your left foot drops as you're a left-handed thrower, think about what happens to your glove that we work so hard with that wide base to get in front of.
Right.
To get in front of our body. And if we start staggering our feet too much, what's going to happen to our glove that we got into the perfect position? It's going to start to come back toward our body.
It has no choice
now
to.
Now we really shot ourselves in the foot, so
yeah.
to speak.
That's a great point. Awesome. Okay, walk into footwork. Now we funneled. We're right in that position. We've got the baseball in the center of our chest. Now footwork to throw.
Okay, well, basically three and four happen at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, the field, the ball's in your glove. As you start to funnel, your feet start to move. Once again, let me just preclude this. And you can argue about this until the cows come home. But there are 9 different ways to skin a cat.
Yep.
This works for me. This works for my style. This has worked for me over a long period of time. My players believe in it. This is what I teach.
Okay.
I'm not saying this is the only way. This is saying this is what I do. This is my way.
Okay.
So with that being said, once I catch the ball, you've got to cross your feet sheets to get angles. You got to get, create angles to get to the ball certain places on the field.
Sure.
Once that ball's in your glove, once you field the ball and you start to funnel it, I don't want my feet to ever cross again. Here's the reason why. I want the 2 D's, as in dog, I want the 2 D's to happen at the same time. The two D's are, I want to create distance toward my target and direction toward my target as quick as I can. Now, let's break this down. If I got my wide base and I've caught the ball and I'm funneling, my formula to this, if I'm a right-handed thrower, is right to left, left to my target. Mm-hmm. My right foot goes where my left foot is, but my left foot doesn't stick around to wait for it. My right foot goes to my left, but my left has already gone toward my target.
Direction. Yep.
This will take your left shoulder, who you, by the way, through the funnel, you've already created a perfect front side for. Mm-hmm. This will take you directly to your target every single time. Hmm. Now, if you have a slow runner, you don't have the proper grip, something else has happened, replace your feet again. I call it replacing your feet. Your right replaces your left goes to your target. So you replace your feet. I use this as the same example on the secondary lead. If you're taking a secondary lead, Sheets, and you're coaching your team, and all of a sudden you see a guy's left foot goes in front of his right, or his left foot goes in back of his right.
Yeah.
What are you going to tell him?
We're going to stop and talk about that for a second.
Right. I don't think you're going to have very good balance. You're not going to be a very good control, and you're really not gaining a whole lot of ground.
And so not athletic.
I have no problem with people who want to lead with their right foot. The only reason, if I catch a ground ball, I don't want to lead with my right foot. You can act this one out for with me if you want.
Doing it.
If I start to catch the ball and I'm funneling, I want to create the two D's at the same time. Okay, if I lead with my right foot, granted, I am going toward first base or going toward my target. Mm-hmm. I am gaining some ground. I'll give you that. But look at your left shoulder. Is it not in the same position it was when you caught the ball? Don't you have to do something else to make your direction happen?
Mm-hmm.
The answer is yes.
Yeah.
So my theory is, and it's simply my theory, what I teach, I want those two things to happen at the same time. So if I go right to left, left to target, or if I'm left-handed, if I go left to right, right to target, the two D's happen at the same time, distance and direction.
That's it. So our listeners know, I was giving it to Perry a couple of days ago talking about that, because for the longest time, I learned that early on in my career was the power step. And that's exactly what you termed it as. It was the power step that CrossFit, and you gave me that exact example. And he had me up in the office moving around. I'm doing it right now at the desk with the microphone. But it makes so much sense. And talking about getting the two D's, getting distance and direction, is to obviously replace, get right to left, and then left towards your base.
Right. I'm not saying you can't throw like that.
Right.
I'm not saying that at all. I'm not saying that won't work. But for me, I want to get the two D's at the same time as quick as I can.
Mm-hmm.
I look at it this way, and I've done this a million times, Sheets, and if we were on the field, I could do it a million more, and I could show you. We as infielders think we have 90 feet to work with. We don't have 90 feet to work with.
That's right.
We have anywhere from 65 to 70 feet to work with. By the time the ball gets to us, that hitter, that batter runner is usually 20 to 25 feet out of the box already. The more we have to do puts more pressure on our first baseman. If we make a bad throw or he's got to adjust his feet or he has to come off the bag. So I want to make things happen as quickly as I can, as fundamentally sound as I can.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I teach what I call replacing your feet.
That's it. Which brings us to the fifth F, which is fire. And if you've done the first four, this is really, you shouldn't have to think about anything. You're just letting loose of the baseball and moving it. But talk about fire in terms of what you teach with your guys in that position.
Now you're ready to throw the ball. I came up with six Fs. I couldn't have five Fs and a T. It didn't sound very good.
That's right.
So I had to come up with something. So I said fire.
Uh-huh.
So now you're actually ready to fire the ball. All your momentum, you've prepared the ball. You've got your front side. You got your short arm. Your elbows up, your hands on top of the ball, but your right to left, left to target footwork. You've created the distance and direction. You've got momentum going. Now you let her go. Now you let her go. And as you well know, and all the coaches listening, you throw with your feet. You don't throw with your arm. I got my feet moving in the right direction with momentum, with distance and direction, the two Ds. Now I don't have to worry. I'm pretty good confident my ball's going to get there. And the sixth F is follow. Just anytime you throw a ball, you want to take one or two more steps at the release point to make sure that your arm goes all the way through, that you don't recoil, that you go all the way through and make sure that you pull that ball, pull it through, take two or three steps, one or two steps, however many you need to make sure that your arm goes all the way through. This gives you a little bit more carry. And it really helps a lot with your accuracy also.
I was talking with a group of coaches early on in my coaching career, and what it came back to was we were talking about guys that have sore arms. And it came down to a couple things. So you can boil it down. Let me see what you think about this. If you got a middle infielder, got a sore arm, a lot of ground balls, playing, practicing, whatever it is, he's got a sore arm. Comes back to, obviously, his arm's not in shape, so we need to think about our catch play routine, long toss, whatever it is to get in shape. But it probably comes back to his feet. Comes back to his footwork as he prepares to throw. He's not using his feet to really take the ease off the arm. Would you agree with that?
100%.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to make total sense.
If your footwork is not good, then at some point in time, your body says, oh, shoot, I'm not lined up to my target. Mm-hmm. So what's going to happen? Your arm is going to drop to make the adjustment to get back to your target. And if you do that over and over and over again, you're going to put stress on your elbow or your shoulder, and eventually you are going to get a sore arm.
Yeah.
You know, the six Fs work together in conjunction with each other, and it is designed, number one, to be simple, and it's designed for one-word keys, and it's designed to keep you from getting hurt.
Love it. Now, we were talking the other day, and I got into asking Perry because I want to see what he would offer in terms of their daily routine. Okay, so when you walk out with the Marlins infielders and your daily routine, and, you know, Major League Baseball, slightly different than obviously what we can do in the youth and high school and college levels. But, again, back to keeping things simple. You've got a basic warm-up routine that your guys go through each and every day. And it's, again, the foundation of what you do on infield play. Can you open up what you do with those guys before, obviously, pregame, before BP?
Well, we start this the first day of spring training.
Okay.
And I got a outline, if you will, of the daily things that we do. And like I told you yesterday or the day before when we talked, is that I had a problem with infielders never really getting prepared before they took a ground ball. For instance, I talked to you about a hitter swinging the bat, doing soft toss,
right,
Hitting off the tee, swinging a weighted bat. Talk about pitchers, you know, playing long toss, playing catch before they throw their bullpen or even before they go out to pitch in a game.
Mm-hmm.
I've talked to all the players. They always go out and stretch and run before they play the game or work out. Everybody stretches, everybody runs. We play catch to get our arms loose. But what does an infielder do to get his feet and his hands ready? The last thing I want to happen is to go out on the field after I've just stretched and played a little catch and the stinking coach to hit me a ground ball at 100 miles an hour. I don't want that.
Sure.
I want to lead and progress into that. I want to warm up my infielding skills. You know, we have so many coaches that are able to be in spring training to help out and to get things done. And I understand the high school, maybe college coaches don't have as many bodies as I'm fortunate to have. Mm-hmm. The players can do this to themselves.
Right.
What I do is I'm the knee drill. Everybody's probably done the knee drill before. I like to back up, put the infielder on his knees, back up about 25 feet, choke up on a fungo, hit a ground ball to his right, let him forehand that ball, funnel it to the middle and discard the ball. Then I'll hit one to his backhand side, other side of his body, mm-hmm, let him backhand it, funnel it, and then discard the ball. This is my way of warming up an infielder's hands.
That's right.
Getting to see the ball, move his glove back and forth, warming up his hands, watching the ball go in the glove, and just getting his hands loose.
Taking the lower half out of the play.
Yes, I'm just warming up my hands.
Yeah.
That's all I'm doing.
Yeah.
I'm warming up my hands. Just like a runner warms up his feet, just like a pitcher warms up his arm, I'm doing the same thing. I'm just warming up my hands, getting ready for the day's work. The second drill I do is then I stand the infielder up, and he gets into the perfect fielding position, as we talked about in the 6Fs, number mm-hmm. 2, field. Mm-hmm. I get them 2 to 3 inches wide of their shoulders. I'm the same 25 feet away, and I hit the ground ball right to them in the middle of their body, mm-hmm, right to them. They don't have to move their feet. What I'm doing now, Chief, is I'm reinforcing, mm-hmm, before I start my day's work, I'm reinforcing the perfect fielding position.
There it is.
There are days, well, I will put a ball down by my foot where I'm standing, and I'll make the infielder get down in his wide base and lay his glove out in front of him. He's got to nod his head that he can see the ball by my foot, and he can see his glove at the same time before I will hit the ball.
Mm.
To reinforce that in his head. Yes, I see that ball way out there, mm-hmm, and yes, I can see my gloves. Other days, I just hit them, let them control and coach themselves. Other days, I'll put that ball down there and make sure they know and remind themselves the purpose of this drill.
Is there a little bit of trying to get your eyes on the same level of the baseball? That could be another coaching cue that guys could use, trying to get their eyes down there on the same level as the ground ball.
Yes.
Yeah.
And once again, the wide base takes care of that.
That's right, 100%.
If you say wide base,
mm-hmm,
you don't have to talk about looking way out there. It's all going to happen automatically.
That's it.
And once again, that's after you explain the 6Fs, one time, the first explanation can get a little inky, like it did today in our interview.
Sure.
But once I explain that, to my players and I have their undivided attention, now it becomes a one word thing. I don't have to say, get your butt down, or can you see way out there? I'm going to say field, wide base. Then they know, hands out front automatically. I can see the ball in the glove at the same time. I have great balance. My butt's automatically down. I don't have to worry about all that garbage.
Love it. So you got them on their knees, you go into wide base, and then you go into off-wall, coach rolls, all that stuff.
Right. Now, in spring training, it's volume. I'm going to get as many ground balls as I can before the game starts. Because as you well know, and all the coaches listening know, that you can go out before they report to whatever the season starts, and they can run as many wind sprints as they want, as long as the distances they want, as many shuttle things around cones as they want. But fielding ground balls is going to be baseball shape. Mm-hmm. I want to field as many ground balls as I can the first 10 days or 2 weeks before the game starts. So once the game starts, I know my legs are not going to be sore.
Sure.
So spring training is a separate entity. Now, once that starts, once the game starts, or even during the season, once I do the knees and the wide base, I do not hit the first ground balls that I actually throw the take the guys out. If I take Martin Prado out for some extra work at third base, I just want him. He hasn't had a ball hit to him in 3 games. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm going to go out and do a day's work with him in the middle of July. We've already played 100 games. This is what I would do. I would do the knees. I would do the wide base. And then when I put him out at third base, the first 10 balls I would do, I would roll them to him. Roll the ball. What I need to see, he needs to feel what he feels before I even thought about hitting the ball with any kind of speed toward him. I'll roll 3 or 4 right at him. He'll do the 6 Fs, throw across the diamond. I'll throw 3 or 4 backhands, which we're not going to have enough time to talk about today, obviously. Maybe another time we can talk about the backhand.
Yeah.
I'll throw 3 or 4 balls to his left. Now, when that's done, I see that everything is perfect. He feels good about himself. Then I'll back up, and now I'll take the fungo. Now, with the fungo, I can control what I want to do. If I want to work on his backhand, I can control it with the fungo. If I just want to get some general work done, I can go fungo. I can control the fungo and hit it wherever I want, whenever I want, and get his work in. Now we're all feeling real good about everything. Now he hasn't had a ball hit to him in 3 or 4 days. Let's play the game. Let's get game situations. So I'll say runner on second, nobody out. Runner on first, one out. But now I'll have somebody up at home plate with me that will actually flip me the ball, soft toss it, and I'm facing the mound, and now I'll swing just like the same pitcher he would get in a game.
Right.
And I'm the hitter. Now he reacts to the ball. I don't know where it's going. He doesn't know where it's going.
Mm-hmm.
But what we've done is we've used a progression to make him feel good about himself, to reinforce all the fundamentals, to get him warmed up. And now when it really counts, he's ready to go.
I love that. And to your point, I mean, we do that in every other facet, whether it's before BP, our guys are doing soft toss, tee work, front toss to get into BP, your pitchers are band work, playing long toss, you know, flat grounds into bullpens. We're just bringing that to infield play, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I couldn't have said it better. Exactly what you're doing. Why should infielders suffer? Everybody else does it.
Yeah.
Why don't we do it?
That's it.
And here's the other thing, Sheet, is that sounded like a lot of stuff right there, but you're talking 20 knees, 20 balls right out of wide base.
Yeah.
You're talking rolling 10 balls. You're talking 10 or 15 fungos. And then you're talking 10 or 15 live. That's no more than a 15 to 17 minute work. I've timed it for years.
Yeah, that's right.
He's not out there. He's not tired. Now he has BP off. He's done all his work. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have to take balls again in BP unless he just really wants to.
Sure.
But his work is done. And the other reason I like this too is I get it done and they don't have to worry about the sound of the bat. A lot of times in BP, some guys will get a little edgy and I understand that. They'll catch the ball, wait for the bat, and then they'll start their feet again. Mm-hmm. I want everything to work in a continuous motion. And
that's
the value of one-on-one early work for me.
Absolutely. You mentioned Martin Prado and talking through your infield routine. You had a really good story about him in terms of you when you brought that to him. Can you open that up for our guys?
Well, I didn't know this till I did an interview on ESPN one day. The guy that was interviewing me, Eduardo Perez, told me, he goes, you know, Martin Prado hated you for a long time.
Right.
I said, what? Because he's been here for 3 years. And I said, he what? What are you talking about? Martin and I are tight.
Sure.
He goes, oh, no. When he first came over from Arizona and you were talking about the 6Fs and doing all this replacing your feet and funneling and all that, He was not very kind to you around some of the players. I said, really? Seriously? I said, well, hang with him. It's your fault for getting traded to Miami.
but obviously, he reveres you now. I mean, as an infield coach.
Yeah, it all worked out. All worked out. Everybody's he's one of my all time favorites, and he's a great player, a great talent. And I'll put it this way about Martin Prado. I read a quote, Chipper Jones said, Martin Prado was the best teammate he ever had.
Wow.
That's saying a lot.
That is, 100%. Now,
what else you got?
Well, I know that I'm going to scratch this itch for you because we started getting into it the other day on the call is first base play. And that's an area that where a lot of those guys get neglected. Or maybe there's just not a lot of coaches that feel adequate enough to walk over and truly have tangible things to teach these guys at first base. Can you open that up for our guys?
Well, there's a million ways, things to do at first base, to play it properly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just not put the guy over there and tell him to run and put his foot on the white thing and catch the ball. I can talk for hours about first base play. At my level, what I try to do is I try, and being a National League coach, you got your four starting infielders, mm-hmm. and you got two utilities, and then you have two catchers. I try to make sure that the two catchers and the two utility guys can play first base. Number one, the two utility guys should be able to play all four positions.
Yep.
Because in the National League, you don't have to burn two players. If you pinch run or pinch hit, he can go in and play any position.
Sure.
So all of my utility players do work at all four positions.
Hmm.
A lot of times I took JP Realmuto out, our catcher this year, and taught him how to play first base. Sometimes you got that top left-handed pitcher to give Justin Bohr, our first baseman, who's a left-hand hitter, give him a day off,
mm-hmm.
and it gets the catcher, starting catcher, off his legs,
yep.
and it gets the backup catcher time, you know, some playing time too. So, you know, I always use first base plays for a lot of different guys. But I will say this, and I know our time's limited, and I could go a million ways here, but one of the common things I see at first base is when a first baseman covers the bag and he's receiving a throw from another player. A lot of times if there's like a ground ball to third, I'll see that the right-handed first baseman go put his foot on the corner closer on the side part of the baseline, if you're following me.
Yeah.
On the corner closer to home plate. To me, that's wrong. The theory there is, well, I'm closer to the guy with the ball. To make it simple, and you can kind of picture this in your mind,
yep.
A right-handed first baseman should anchor at the corner farthest from his glove. So a right-handed first baseman should anchor at the corner inside the baseline, mm-hmm. toward the closer to right field. And here's the reason why. Look where your glove is. Your glove is on your left side of your body. What's the toughest throw for a right-handed first baseman to catch? Up the line's the easiest one to catch. It's toward right field. It's toward the right field bullpen. It's toward the tarp. It's that way. Well, if I anchor at that corner, I don't have to do anything with my footwork. All I have to do is take my glove to the ball, try to catch the ball. I don't have to do anything with my feet. The ball that's up the line inside me, that's easy. There's my glove. It's right there.
Sure.
And if it's a little further up the line, now I only have to worry about moving my feet one direction. I just move it up the line, and it's easy because my glove is already up the line for me. The toughest throw for me to catch is the one that's away from my glove. That's the one I got to be careful about.
Mm.
So just the opposite for a left-handed first baseman. You anchor at the corner farthest from your glove. So the left-handed first baseman, when he gets to the bag, would have his left foot on that inside corner closer to home plate. Why? What's the toughest throw for the left-handed first baseman to catch?
Obviously,
the one that goes up the line.
Sure.
His glove is out here toward right field.
So now my
footwork is already done for me on the tough throw. Now I just have to take the glove and my right foot and go to the ball and catch it. My footwork for the toughest throw is already done. If the ball goes toward right field, I only have to worry about moving my feet in one direction only. Plus, my glove is already over on that side of my body, and it's a much easier catch.
Great. I'm sure our guys are taking notes. We're all doing this inside, listening to these on earbuds, and we're working our feet. That's a tremendous insight. Perry, you've been so forthright with your time, and we do not end a show unless we ask this question of any guest that we're sitting down and chatting with, and that comes back to advice for coaches. So if there's anything else in your pocket you want to empty out, give them to our coaches as just advice from your perspective that can certainly set them off on a better path.
Make sure you exhaust all avenues before you give up on a player. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Try everything. If you run out of things, ask somebody. I've had a lot of players over the years who people were ready to write off and throw away and ended up having tremendous major league careers. So I can, I'm in my basement right now. I kind of got a little man cave here, and I just walked past a picture of Dan Uggla. And Dan Uggla was basically thrown away. We didn't give up on Dan Uggla.
Right.
Dan Uggla hit 25, 30 homers and second base in the big leagues for over 10 years. Yeah. Hit 25, 30 homers a year for 6 years in a row. I know that.
Mm-hmm.
And was a pretty darn good major league player because somebody believed in him and didn't give up on him. So my advice is you're going to have players that have bad days. We all have bad days. You're going to have players that have bad weeks. But let's just try not to give up on players.
Love it. Bone, I really appreciate you making time for us, man. Again, anytime we can connect with someone that's got your experience and we can get that on the call, we can certainly give our listeners some tremendous content that they can take back to their infield core and work to make themselves and their players and their programs better. We certainly want to take advantage of that. So again, thanks for jumping on our call. We wish you the best of luck, and we look forward to catching up again with you real soon, Perry.
Okay, Sheets, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
What a great episode. I'm going to leave this outro right now. I'm going to walk out to the ABCA National Office parking lot. I'm going to take some GB. So if you want to come out and join me, let's get some work in. Just some terrific insight from one of the very best in Perry Hill from the Miami Marlins. Again, it's obvious how boiled down and simple Bone keeps it for his guys. And with over 40 years in the game, the numerous gold gloves his infielders have racked up over the years, the fact that his teams have led Major League Baseball in the fewest team errors multiple times, in just how those around the inner circle talk about Perry and revere him as a person and also as a coach. Once again, find him on social media at phill_bone and also check out his website, goldglovedefense.com. Connect with Coach Hill. Thanks again for your time, your information, Bone. We appreciate your willingness to share and connect with our coaches, and we wish you and the Marlins the very best of luck moving forward. So if you love this episode or any of our other shows, please reach out to us. We love the feedback and hearing from our loyal listeners. You can start by sharing this show with those around you. So go on Twitter, find one of our quote images with the links that are inside that tweet, retweet that out, add your own message, quote tweet it, pull the link off, and text message folks in your phone. Let me help you out. Maybe a little bit of, hey, just wanted to make sure you saw this. Or, hey, here's a resource with some great baseball info that might help. You never know when a resource or a simple nudge can move someone down the right path. So reach out to us, guys. You can find us on Twitter at ABCA1945. We're also under the same title on Facebook. You can connect with me personally at CoachSheets3 on Twitter or by email, Sheets, Sheets, at ABCA.org. We'd love to hear from you and help out anyone that's interested in growing and developing as a coach, but also as a learner. Just a little FYI, I want you to think about marking down Tuesday, November 28th, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Put that in black Sharpie on your calendar. Don't miss our next hashtag ABCA chat on Twitter. We're going to follow up this podcast with an online chat. We'll be joined by coaches from around the world. We ask questions so coaches can share their info, but they're also connecting and networking with one another. And it's only for an hour, and it could be the very best hour you invest in learning all week long. You're building your network, you're growing as a coach, you're challenging what you teach. Join us Tuesday, November 28th, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, our very next hashtag ABCA chat. So with Twitter in mind, we just wrapped up our ABCA Barnstormers Regional Coaching Clinics this past weekend. And we've got images and videos from every single tour stop out there for you to find. Check out hashtag ABCA Clinics. So search ABCA Clinics, click latest, and you can scroll your way back through all those videos we put out from some of the very best teaching professionals in those areas of the country. Huge thanks to our clinicians. They were phenomenal for us out there on the road. Our host staffs were being so gracious and accommodating, but also every single coach that sacrificed their Saturday or Sunday to join us at the ballpark and enhance their knowledge. Help us connect and strengthen baseball communities around the country, all while growing and furthering the game of baseball. Thank you across every single front, guys. And look out for next year's Barnstormers Clinic tours. We're going to move to more of a national tour, working to hit each and every corner of the U.S. We're on a mission to find more coaches who are as fired up about learning as we are. We'll see you on next year's Barnstormers Clinics Tour. And coaches who think that way, that's what makes the ABCA such a tremendous baseball coaches association. The fraternity, if you will. And we hope you're one of our 2017-18 ABCA members. If you are, you're taking full advantage of the extensive membership benefits that we offer our coaches. It pays to be a member here at ABCA with over 7,000 coaches worldwide already on board with us this year. And we're only into our third month of membership. We're growing, but we want you with us. Plus, if you join the ABCA, we want to make sure you know about our ABCA National Convention. We're coming to Indianapolis this January 4th through the 7th, and we're planning for over 6,000 coaches to be joining us there. It's going to be a can't-miss opportunity, and there's nothing else like our ABCA show. Over 45 teaching clinics, 25 on the main stage, another 20 in our Expo Theater, our Hall of Fame banquet, our Honors Luncheon, the raffle where you can win baseball products and equipment. You could walk around the world's largest baseball trade show. Cross that off your bucket list. You could come see the most handsome podcast host in the country. You could give me a bear hug. Yet another bucket list item for most coaches around the country. But find a way to get to Indy this January. Come see what the ABCA is all about. And another huge thanks to our great friends over at AstroTurf, the leaders in the clubhouse for the turf industry. We appreciate their support of this podcast. And if you want more information, head over to their website, astroturf.com. That's astroturf.com. Gain some insight into what they're doing for facilities around the country and find out why AstroTurf has been ahead of the curve for almost 50 years. So there it is, guys. The rundown is complete, and I am still fired up. We're doing big things here at ABCA, and we appreciate your loyalty to this show and your efforts to help grow coaches and our game around the world. So thank you for that. There's more work to be done. There's more coaches to reach, and that opportunity keeps us grinding away each and every day. So as always, coaches, thank you guys for listening in and staying dialed into our Calls from the Clubhouse podcast. And until next week, we ask you to keep growing, keep developing, keep challenging yourself inside this game. We wish you and your club the very best, and thank you for what you're doing for the game of baseball.